And now, the Great American Folk Show, a little place on the radio where we commune with you to share stories, sing songs, and talk to some good people with great voices. Stay with us over the next hour as we bring you actor John C. Reilly, journalist and viral food columnist Marilyn Haggerty, musicians Heidi Gluck and Tom Lennon, plus artist Penny Sue Burkham on feather tree making. I'm Joe Wiegand. Good to have you with us on Prairie Public. Here's your host, Tom Brousseau.
Marilyn Haggerty is the author of two books. Both are a collection of some of her writing from the 1960s on up to today. Echoes, published by the Grand Forks Herald in 1994, and Grand Forks, A History of American Dining in 128 Reviews, published by Echo in 2013. At this moment, Marilyn is in her 90s and lives in Grand Forks, North Dakota, and she continues to write for a few different papers every week. She's quite prolific. Eat Beat is her most famous column, which has been in operation for nearly half a century, and maybe that's where you first heard of Marilyn Haggerty. Does a food review on the Olive Garden ring a bell? She reports on people, places, food, and she writes in a voice that is unique, important, and flecked with charm. Marilyn's own real voice is also something special, so I thought, wouldn't it be nice to have her on the program? Marilyn Haggerty reads her food review on Bonzer's Sandwich Pub.
Bonzer's on 4th still excites taste buds after 10 years. March 3rd, 1993. Television sets are running. Music plays from the speaker system. Conversation rises from the high-backed booths. The gentlemen from Bartles and James Ad jump out from the lighted sign. Peanut shells are strewn on the terrazzo floor. This is Bonzer's, the nearest thing to a pub in Grand Forks. From 11 a.m. until 3:30 p.m., Bonzer's is a lunch place. You can get German fare on Thursdays. Late in the afternoon, it turns into a place where people meet for happy hour or a light supper, or both. Cindy Bonzer, who operates the pub with her husband John, says, "We're selling more food and less wine and beer now, but I think that's true everywhere." The Bonzers opened their downtown sandwich pub 10 years ago this week. We were worried about business when Norby's department store closed in early 1986, but we found more professional people coming in. And we have UND students who live downtown apartments picking up the slack. In fact, she says, business has been better for Bonzers each passing year. We thought of applying for a liquor license, and then we wondered why, with things going so well just selling wine and beer. The Bonzers haven't rocked the boat. The walls and shelves are still decorated with the beer memorabilia. John started collecting those in junior high school in California. As a matter of fact, he is a member of the Beer Can Collectors of America. He is always trading and buying to enhance his collection of trays, cans, bottles, pictures. He proudly displays a Dakota beer can from the short-lived brewery in Bismarck. He says it is one of the most valuable in the nation. Booths of dark wood provide semi-privacy for patrons. The wooden bar with 10 high-backed wooden stools provides a spot for loners or twosomes. A fake tree with forever autumn leaves stands at the back of the pub. Then in the corner there's a private dining area called the boardroom. It can be reserved for groups of around a dozen at no charge. Constant Companion and I paid a visit to Bonzer's late Thursday afternoon. For some people it was happy hour. For us it was supper time. I had a cup of split pea and ham soup and a half of a hot pastrami sandwich, $2.85. CC had a bowl of chili con carne, $1.95, with a Michelob. The chili was hot, hot, hot. The brew was dry. There's nothing namby-pamby about the food at Bonzer's. It is spiced and flavored enough to make a statement. Soups, which are made by the owners, are thick and hot. Sometimes customers come regularly for soup. along with soup and a long list of sandwiches, Bonzer's offers an array of mini salads for $3.25 and large salads for $4.25. The main menu is cleverly written and reflects the good humor of the Bonzers.
Take a trip with me to Ojai, California. To get there, we'll drive north from Los Angeles on the PCH, which, for the most of it, will put us right next to the Pacific Ocean. Along the way, we'll stop for a bite at the famous Neptune's Net in Malibu, a roadside attraction of sorts, for a clam strips basket, lemonade, and while we're at it, take in a little of the local scene. Surfing and sunbathing and motorcycles. Just as we're about to pass Ventura, we'll swing a right. We'll be leaving the coast, the waves, the boats, the piers, those blue waters and all of that, and entering a peaceful rolling valley with fruit trees and horses and cool heat, which, just you wait, will unfold into a line of the most beautiful California country communities you ever did see. Casitas Springs, Oak View, Miner's Oaks, and Ojai, a Chumash word for moon. That's where our next guest resides, singer-songwriter Tom Lennon.
Thank you. do me wrong, get it right this time, I'll be strong. You know I don't cry. Get along, you don't have to lie, just do me wrong, but get it right this time. Time before, you said we were through, then you stayed, kept me wanting you with my heart hanging on the line. So do me wrong, but get it right this time. I told you I'd hold you and make you mine, but maybe, my baby, you be gone this time. Do me wrong, get it right this time, I'll be strong. You know I'll survive. If it's over, it cannot be kind. So do me wrong, but get it right this time. Do me wrong, but get it right this time.
Hi, my name's Tom Lennon. I'm a singer-songwriter born and raised in Venice, California. I'm the third oldest of 13 children, 8 boys and 5 girls. I grew up in a simpler time for being a kid, spent lots of time at the beach or fishing in the Venice canals, visiting Hoppyland Amusement Park, named after Hopalong Cassidy, the cowboy actor, before the Marina del Rey was built on that site. I had a paper route after school, which I inherited from my older brother, 80 customers in 6 blocks. I once did my deliveries in 4.5 minutes flat. I had a charge account at Knickerbocker's Drugstore, which was located at the halfway point of my route. They had a classic soda fountain with upholstered red leather stools. You could find me there like Norm at Cheers, sitting at the counter, half my papers delivered, enjoying a cherry Coke or a vanilla phosphate. I went all through grammar school and high school with my cousin Janet Lennon, the youngest of the Lennon sisters of Lawrence Welk show fame. We once got to appear as preteens on the cover of Playmate magazine together. This was before Hugh Hefner got a hold of that sobriquet. My older sister and I would do a lot of the babysitting of our younger siblings. On Saturday nights in the late 50s, we would watch a local TV show called Town Hall Party. It was a country-western variety show that would sometimes feature a brother-sister act called the Collins Kids. Lori and Larry Collins. She was 16 and he was 14. She played an acoustic guitar and he played a double-neck electric. I was 12 at the time and I had a crush on her and wanted to be like him. He was an amazing showman. He would hop across the stage with his guitar a la Chuck Berry, all the while grinning ear to ear. If he was 18, he'd have been obnoxious, but he was only 14 and just incredible. That was my inspiration to play the guitar and a really good lesson in showmanship, connecting with an audience. There was something about what he was doing that really resonated with me. Something invisible and magical was occurring. My mom was always very supportive of the arts, being an accomplished dancer and artist herself. She took me to get my first guitar from Harvey's House of Music in Santa Monica. I got a new acoustic guitar and 10 lessons for $29.95. First song, Down in the Valley. Sadly, I only completed 5 of those lessons as Harvey passed away at 79 years of age. I had to sue his estate for the remainder of my money. Not really. I continued with another teacher, Ben Henderson, who had a studio next door to Knickerbocker's Drugstore. I soon found out that I had a good ear and could learn songs by listening and watching him play. But I was supposed to be learning to read music. Well, Ben caught on to my act and purposely wrote some notes into my lesson that would find me out when it came time to play it for him. Aha! I knew it. You're playing by ear. During high school, I got to play guitar and sing on a folk song album, The Lennon Sisters and Cousins Sing Dominique and Other Folk Songs. I had a vocal solo on If I Had My Way. I think the album sold 37 copies, mostly to family and friends. I formed a Kingston Trio group with some buddies, and we won the talent show our junior year with Hard Ain't It Hard and MTA. I've kept several songs in my repertoire from those days, Sloop John B., Zombie Jamboree, Marie Christina, and Scotch and Soda. I sing Zombie Jamboree and Maria Christina if I've got family members in the audience. They're call and response songs that are a lot of fun. After high school, I spent a year in civil engineering at Loyola University. That wasn't a good fit, and I like to say I drunked out rather than flunked out of that plan. From there, I got a job at MGM Studios working in the mailroom, delivering mail to the offices and sound stages. Got to deliver a telegram to Elvis, well, to his manager, Colonel Tom Parker, but Elvis was right there making a racing movie. I teamed up with a few co-workers to form a band called The Other Half. We basically did cover tunes of the day, The Stones, Yardbirds, Birds, The Who. Our keyboard player was a guy named John Branca. We had to let him go because he wasn't 18 yet, and we got a gig at the Reseda Bowling Alley Lounge, where everybody had to be at least 18. Well, he showed us. He went on to become the premier entertainment attorney, namely Michael Jackson's main attorney for all his music deals and estate. I got drafted into the Army in 66, spent 2 years stateside, got out and went to junior college for an AA degree in music. I enjoyed the theory and especially the harmony classes. I started listening to country music in the 70s, especially Merle Haggard. What a voice, so natural. That got me interested in the lyrics and messages in the songs. Simple, heartfelt, relatable. I like how they would tug at my heartstrings and felt that maybe I could find expression for my own experiences there. It didn't hurt that most of them utilized cowboy chords and simple chord progressions. I began to aspire to sounding as much like Merle as I could, emulating his natural style. I felt like my voice needed to mature some to get there. I learned several of his songs on the guitar and managed to put together a couple of them with my wife Debbie on the fiddle. It was while driving a bread truck on my way to my bread route that I began formulating a song. The melody just sort of arrived in league with the hum of the big six-cylinder engine, and that set the tone or feeling for what followed. I always liked the way a one chord added a seventh to lead to a four chord, and I crafted the first line of the melody to purposely go there to set an anticipatory feeling that sought resolution while adding a bluesy feeling. That suggested a mood for a lyric. I got home last night, seventh, sort of late-ish four chord. That fed the next line, which sort of mirrored the first, using the five chord as a base. You got home last night, 5-7. Even later, one chord. Back to the first line, I don't think that's right, seventh, little lady, four chord. Lately, that don't seem to bother you. The last line resolving by releasing from the pattern while continuing the alliteration, all the L words. I love the way Crosby, Stills, and Nash use alliteration in Helplessly Hoping, almost ad nauseum. The task after that was to keep the storyline alive without revealing the protagonist until the last verse as much as possible. That was my first song. The thoughts in my head at the time were of a teenage daughter, though my own daughter at the time was only 3 or 4. A family friend, a real country girl, said I should title it Cookies on the Doorstep. I thought that was a pretty good way to say it, though I stayed with the original tagline, Lately That Don't Seem to Bother You. That song, as well as the two that I'll be singing today, became part of an album, The Other Half, which I recorded with my brother Michael.
I've been in love, but I think it's in vain. Is it really love when there's nothing but pain? Zig really love, but she's breaking my heart. Zig really love, but she tears it all apart. Telling me lies, making me cry. Hey, what is a guy supposed to do? Would you believe that I bought her a ring? She put it on, said this don't mean a thing. Wish I'd have known, for I took it all so far. Wish I'd have known, for I sold my old guitar. It was a Gibson, better than this one. Hey, I should have stayed in my own yard. I'm gonna go call on her again. I don't know why she don't treat me like a friend. I'm gonna go and give her what for. I'll let her know she can't do me this no more. I've been on her seesaw. If you'd seen what I saw, you'd be on a teeter-totter too.
You're listening to Prairie Public.
A few years ago now, a friend of my grandmother Lil came over to my parents' house while I was home for the holidays to teach me and my siblings, Carrie and Ben, and my brother-in-law Josh how to make lefse the old-fashioned way, thin. While my mother raised us to love our Norwegian roots, and like most people of Norwegian descent living in the Great Plains, that sense of pride really shows on May 17th, Sutten Demai, for Norwegian Constitution Day, and at Christmas time, making lefse isn't something we ever attempted to do in our household when we were growing up. Krumkaka, Fuddiman, Rollaposa, I remember. My mother made blood soup, but that came already made from L&M meats. You just had to thaw it out. Never lefse, though. My grandmother Lil had been passed away at that point for a while, and we all really missed her a lot, especially since it was Christmas time. But it was fun to be around one of her closest friends, Evelyn Hensrud. Evelyn and my grandmother Lil even bore resemblance. Short hair, hair white as snow, blue walnut-shaped eyes, and an honest way of speaking without trying to be too polite. So, on top of getting lessons in lefse, it kind of felt like we had our grandmother back again in the kitchen for a couple hours, and wasn't that nice. Now, lefse is made up of but a few ingredients, and really it's not time-consuming. But somehow, it's not easy stuff to make. In short, it's a moist potato tortilla that you butter and sugar on one side and roll up tight like a cigar and enjoy with a cup of coffee. When it came time to roller pin the dough, Evelyn said to us, "Thin, gotta be thin. That's the way you make it." She then followed it up by saying something like this. "Our ancestors didn't have much, you know. What they did have, they made last. Anyone can make lefse. It's only potato, cream, salt, and butter. But when you strive to make it thin, you honor your relatives and their way of life, and that's what really counts. Besides, lefse just tastes better thin, and you don't have to feel guilty about having another piece." Traditions. That's what Evelyn was talking about. They're precious stuff, and we all have them. What are some of yours? Here's artist Penny Sue Burkham from Council Bluffs, Iowa, to share a tradition of her own, feather tree making.
So when I first heard about feather trees, I wasn't very interested because they sounded like fluffy feathers on a cone or something. I didn't understand what they were. But once I understood what they really were, I was fascinated by the ingenuity and the imagination of the people that made them. And so I just knew it was something that I wanted to do. I wanted to make a feather tree. So a friend of mine, she found an article on how to make one, and another friend happened to have a bag of feathers, and so I was off. But let me tell you a little bit about the history of these really cool trees. They came about in the mid-1800s in Germany, and I guess back then it was really popular to have a tabletop tree for Christmas. And that involved either cutting down a baby tree or cutting the top off of a big tree so they could put it on their table. Well, there were people even back then that were worried about the forests. And so they came up with what was really the first artificial Christmas tree made out of feathers. And once again, I love that these people were so industrious and that they wanted to make do with something that they had. I'm going to tell you a little bit about how they were made, and then a little bit about my journey with it. They took either goose or turkey feathers, and they stripped the feather part off the quill on both sides. And then they wrapped those feathers around a wire, and so it actually looked like little pine needles. Then they would put them on a dowel so that these little branches, I know you've seen them, but you probably didn't realize that they were feather trees or feather tree lookalikes. A lot of people think of them as Charlie Brown trees or something like that, but they're really cooler than that. So I began by, when I decided I was going to make it for people, I had to find the feathers, which is a funny story in itself. But skip ahead, and now I have a good source for those. And I strip them, I wash them, dye them, just get them hot enough to make sure they're nice and clean, and I trim them, and then I wrap them around wires. So their little hairs stick up and they look like, it looks like a pine branch. There are so many people that have wonderful memories of feather trees in their histories. And that's been part of the joy of making this is all I get letters. And when people order them from my Etsy store, people say, "I've been looking for this for a long time. My mom, my grandma has been looking for this for a long time." And then when we go to shows, we hear about people and their feather trees. And it's just a really endearing thing to make for people because it evokes such wonderful memories. And it's just such a beautiful, clean little tree. You just fold its little branches up and put it away. And that was one of the attractive things about it back in the early 1900s is people brought them from Germany. The mercantiles would display their ornaments and stuff on them and then fold them up and put them back. I've kind of branched out, so to speak, and made little candles on the ends and figured out ways to make them look more like wild trees. I just finished making a life-size one for my family, which I know is sort of nuts, so I probably shouldn't have told anybody that. But hopefully it'll be something that we can enjoy from year to year.
Well, Tom, I'll tell you, it's a long story. Long and sad. But here goes. The sun comes up. The sun goes down. The hands on the clock keep going around. I just get up and it's time to lay down. Life gets tedious, don't it? My shoes are untied, but I don't care. I ain't figuring on going nowhere. I'd have to wash and comb my hair. And that's just wasted effort. Water in the well getting lower and lower. Can't take a bath for 6 months more. But I've heard it said, and it's true, I'm sure, that too much bathing will weaken you. I open the door, and the flies swarm in. I shut the door, and I'm sweating again. And in the process, I crack my shin. Just one darn thing after another. Old Brown Mule, he must be sick. I jabbed him in the rump with a pin on a stick. He humped his back, but he wouldn't kick. There's something cockeyed somewhere. A mouse chawing on the pantry door. He's been at it for a month or more. When he gets through, he'll sure be sore, because there ain't a darn thing in there. Hound dog howling, so forlorn. Laziest dog that was ever born. He's howling because he's sitting on a thorn, and he's just too tired to move over. The tin roof leaks and the chimney leans, and there's a hole in the seat of my jeans, and I've ate the last of the pork and beans. Just can't depend on nothing. The cow's gone dry and the hens won't lay. The fish quit biting last Saturday. Trouble's piling up day by day. And now I'm getting dandruff? Grief and misery, pains and woes, and debts and taxes, and so it goes. I think I'm getting a cold in the nose. Life gets tasteless, don't it?
We'd like to take a moment now and thank our sponsor, Hugo's Family Marketplace. Groceries, bakery, deli, floral, you name it. Hugo's, local and family-owned. Serving 10 locations in North Dakota and Minnesota since 1939.
Many know John C. Reilly because of his acting. What's Eating Gilbert Grape? Magnolia. The movie Chicago earned him an Oscar nomination. Scorsese's Gangs of New York. Walk Hard, the Dewey Cox story. Step Brothers with Will Ferrell. More recently, he starred in Stan and Ollie, about the great comedy duo Laurel and Hardy. John played the part of Oliver Hardy, and his performance was high praised by many top critics. Often when someone we love excels in a particular area of the arts, we don't want them to be good at any other thing. They must remain monolithic. Remember when Michael Jordan entered into the world of baseball? He was good. But despite his varied talents, seeing him on a diamond and not on a court was unnatural. The reality is, we're all good at many things. Singer Tony Bennett, did you know that he is also a painter? Well, he is. A pretty good one, too. Next time you're in San Francisco, visit the Fairmont Hotel on Nob Hill. You'll see Bennett's watercolors there, and they're breathtaking. This is like John C. Reilly. He's more than just a famous movie star. He does theater, voice work, dance. He's a producer and a writer. He's also invested in clowns, and by that I mean he studies the history of clowns. Plus, he's got a great singing voice and a good guitar player to boot. That was John earlier in the program singing Red River Valley, which incidentally is Marilyn Haggerty's favorite song. And Life Gets Teaches, Don't It? Written in the 1940s by Carson J. Robison. We'll hear another song from him at the end of the show, but for now, how about another side of John C. Reilly? Here he is reading the short story, When Lightning Struck the Norwegian Lutheran Church.
There were only about 800 people living in our little town when I was growing up. Maybe 500 more lived on farms just outside of town. And even though we were all of Northern European extraction, we thought we were a pretty diverse community because of all the religious denominations in town. There were the Methodists and the Baptists, the Seventh-day Adventists, the Mennonites and the Hutterites. There was one Catholic church in town and three more, French, Czech, and Polish, out in the countryside. There were also a couple of groups that met in homes and whose churches didn't seem to have a name. My grandmother belonged to one of those latter groups. But there were more Lutherans in our community than in all the rest of the denominations put together. So many, in fact, that the Germans, the Swedes, the Norwegians, and the Icelanders each had their own separate Lutheran churches. In addition, there was a fifth Lutheran congregation for folks who didn't identify with one of those nationalities. All these Lutheran groups looked pretty much the same to non-Lutherans, but each of them saw themselves as quite distinct from the others. The ancestors of all these religious groups had immigrated to our area in the 1880s and 1890s. The first generations of each group clustered together, spoke their own languages, and did their best to maintain the traditions of the old country. None of these pioneers had much formal education, but they were all good Christians, and they all had a wealth of practical knowledge that enabled them to build sturdy homes and raise bountiful crops and strong children. One of the first things each group of settlers did was to build their own church. Some of the churches were built of field stone, some of brick, and some of wood. Each church was beautiful in its own unique way. The Norwegian and Swedish churches actually sat right across the road from each other just outside of town. Both were wooden structures. At first, services at each church were conducted in the native language of their founders. By the time I came along, those old languages had been forgotten, and all services were conducted in English. People of my generation didn't see much difference among the churches or the people in their congregations, and we all got along. One night in March, 2 years ago, a freak winter storm blew up out of the south, with thunder and lightning that woke most of the locals from sleep. Old Mrs. Olson, not her real name, told me she got up and looked out her window and saw the glow of a fire burning a couple miles north of her farm. She woke her husband, who was quite hard of hearing and thus oblivious to the sound of thunder. They both got dressed and drove out in the rain to see what was burning. To their horror, it was their church, their Norwegian Lutheran church, and it was already engulfed in flames. The local volunteer fire department was summoned, but there was nothing they could do. Even the heavy rainfall failed to stop the flames from consuming the entire structure. The next morning, folks from all around, including even some of the Swedish Lutherans, gathered to survey the destruction. Everything was in ashes. The church records, the old relics from Norway, pictures and memorabilia, all of it priceless. The only thing that remained was the church bell. What to do now? There were 45 voting members of the congregation, that's not counting the children, and they held a series of meetings in the city hall. They received invitations to join other small Lutheran congregations in the area, all of whom had seen significant declines in their membership in recent years. But still thinking of themselves as Norwegians, they considered those congregations to be just too different, especially the Swedish Lutherans. And the Norwegian Lutherans didn't want to lose their own identity. And then the insurance adjusters came, and it was determined that the mark left by the lightning on the church bell was proof that lightning had indeed caused the fire, and therefore a large payout was in order. With that, plus donations from the church members and many others, the congregation had enough money to rebuild. They took a vote, and by a margin of 44-1, elected to build a new church, rather than distribute the insurance money amongst themselves. Work on the new church started immediately. Volunteers from all the surrounding churches and communities pitched in. The rubble was cleared, a new foundation was dug, and a contractor was hired to build the new structure. Work progressed rapidly. A year after the fire, the new church was ready to be dedicated. Hundreds of people from all around, including many non-Norwegians, came to see the new Norwegian Lutheran Church. The bishop was there, Some folks from Norway even showed up. After the dedication, everyone was invited to lunch in the church basement, and there were plenty of ham sandwiches, macaroni hot dish, and jello salad to go around. They rang the old church bell, too, and many people commented that it sounded even better after being struck by that bolt of lightning from above. The world seemed bright again. And that's the way people are in my hometown. In most ways, we're all pretty much the same, but we're all a little different, too.
It's the Great American Folk Show on Prairie Public.
Heidi Gluck is a multi-instrumentalist, producer, singer, and songwriter living in Lawrence, Kansas. She's been part of many bands over her career in music, played on many albums too, as a session musician. She's also written and released a few titles of her own, and in a moment we'll hear from Heidi Gluck. But first, where does a songwriter get the inspiration from? It's kind of a mystery. Do the lyrics come first, the melody? Do they come at the same time? A poem by Utah Phillips called I Think of You, it may best indicate a source of where inspiration can come from. Here's a couple lines. I look to see the wild flowers blooming. I wonder why they seem so plain. The springtime rides the brown hills over. The young birds sing in a silver rain. Originally, Heidi Gluck is from Canada, a little farm settlement called Low Farm just west of Morris, Manitoba. Search Low Farm on the web, that's L-O-W-E, and the images that will pop up will paint some truly gorgeous scenes. For instance, a grain elevator that towers above a prairie sea, an old abandoned wooden barn frozen in a fall, fields verdant and warm with low-moving wind. It's the land. The land is limitless in the ways in which it can move us. And Low Farm, Manitoba, what an inspirational place for a songwriter to get ideas.
I've been awakened, but never by you. I'm sleepwalking naked, an unwilling tattoo. I'm sure it's nice out there. I'm sure there's beauty everywhere. A wide open road, and one of us should go. Haven't breathed in a while. Air's too thick to go in. Suspicion is snowing. We're frozen in sin. I'm sure it's nice out there. I'm sure there's beauty everywhere. A wide open road, and one of us should go. I'm only sleeping, so I don't have to talk. The pillow's a portal, the blanket's a wall, and I've had so much rest that my mind's getting small. I sure it's nice out there. I'm sure there's beauty everywhere. A wide open road and one of us should go. Yeah, it's nice out there. I'm sure there's beauty everywhere. A wide open road and one of us should go. A wide open road and one of us should go. A wide open road and one of us should go.
Dad was the DJ, but Mom was the musician. She taught lessons, was the church organist, and always made sure we had instruments around to play with. In the 90s, she started a cover band with her friends. Gospel tunes, a number of Creedence songs, other favorite country songs and oldies, and the odd pop rock song. The band practiced in our garage, so this was my first exposure to a full band setup. One week, the bass player got wooed back to his cultish church, which didn't allow such devil music, and he left his gear in our garage for good. I picked it up. It turned out I had a pretty good knack for learning the songs, and became the bass player and backup singer. We mainly played local small-town summer festivals and church programs, and I got enough money out of it so that I didn't have to get a part-time job during high school.
American Folk Show would like to thank John C. Reilly, Marilyn Haggerty, Heidi Gluck, Tom Lennon, and Penny Sue Burkham. Special thanks to Jim Brousseau, who wrote the short story When Lightning Struck the Norwegian Lutheran Church, Vaughn Montgomery in Ojai, California at Greater Goods, Perry Burkham in Council Bluffs, Iowa, our music supervisor Sean Watkins in Los Angeles, California. Lizzie Brousseau in Salt Lake City, Utah. Our sponsor, Hugo's Family Marketplace. Theme song and original instrumentation by Berkham Boys. The Great American Folk Show was written and recorded by Tom Brousseau. Produced and edited by Eric Detheridge and Bill Thomas. I'm Joe Wiegand. May you always find the sun until we meet again.
For more information about this program, please visit www.prairiepublic.org. On the next episode of The Great American Folk Show, New York Times best-selling author Daniel Levitin, North Dakota poet Madeline Camrude, musicians Sarah and Sean Watkins, plus gefilte fish and punk legend and actor John Doe reads the short story Mickey the Dog. We'll see you then.
Well, he's not very handsome to look at. Oh, he's shaggy and eats like a hog. And he's always killing my chickens, that dirty old egg-sucking dog. Egg-sucking dog, I'm gonna stomp your head in the ground. If you don't stay out of my hen house, you dirty old egg-sucking hound. Now if you don't stop eating my eggs up, though I'm not a real bad guy, I'm gonna get my rifle and send him to that great chicken house in the sky.